Chapter 5. Great Balls of Fire. Ball lightning has been puzzling people for thousands of years. It is surprising that despite the fact that numerous photos and films of ball lightning exist, and the fact that it can even be artificially created in the laboratory, this was first achieved in St. Petersburg in 1753 by Georg Richman, though it killed him. There are still people who grumble and complain that it doesn't exist. Ball lightning is a plasmoid, which is to say, a blob of plasma. There are several fascinating books about ball lightning. One of them, Ball Lightning by Mark Stenhoff, published in 1999, has, however, the ominous subtitle, An Unsolved Problem in Atmospheric Physics. Oh dear. Ball lightning is indeed still an enigma, and it may have some connection with the Kordalevsky clouds, as I shall also explain later. Very briefly, ball lightning is generally a spherical, or nearly spherical, glowing ball of fiery light that rolls along the ground or flies through the air, and sometimes passes through solid walls and emerges intact on the other side. It has sometimes been seen rolling down the aisles of passenger planes and frightening people. The first book on ball lightning ever published in Britain, and the first I ever saw, was The Taming of the Thunderbolts, The Science and Superstition of Ball Lightning, by C. Maxwell Cade and Delphine Davis. It was published in 1969, and I came across it and bought a copy in the very early 1970s. They used the word thunderbolts to describe ball lightning because that is what it was called in ancient times. In the early part of the book traces the history of accounts of what was probably ball lightning in the Bible, Ezekiel, and the classical authors Pliny and Lucretius up until modern times. They collected 107 case history accounts, and in their acknowledgments, they said that they spent 5.5 years researching the book and wrote almost 1,000 letters with correspondence in 16 different countries. At the time the book came out, and in the years immediately following, there were derisory reactions, and the authors were assailed by many scientists as having written about something that did not exist and was a mere fantasy. There are now hundreds of scientific publications about it. It has often been photographed, and there are many films of it easily available on YouTube. There is no doubt that it not only exists, but has existed throughout the whole of recorded human history, and doubtless for the whole period of existence of our planet. Ball lightning is indisputably electrical in nature, whatever theory one has for how and why, and has several characteristics in common with traditional descriptions of ghosts. For instance, if there is a high wind and a sphere of ball lightning appears in the air, it can move steadily against the wind as if the wind were not blowing. In other words, the wind does not appear to affect it in any way, even though the glowing sphere is generally rather small, so that it should be so light in weight that the wind would blow it away very fast. Spheres of ball lightning can also, as I say, sometimes pass through solid walls and emerge intact on the other side, as if the walls had not been there. This is what ghosts are often claimed to do. I am not necessarily suggesting that most ball lightning of the usual sort is intelligent, but it is also possible that some ball lightning phenomena are associated with intelligent entities and are even plasmic drones. I say this because a minority of reports describe their behavior in such a way that suggests intelligent control of their movements, as they seem to be inspecting people and things, and also spotting, pursuing, and entering aircraft in flight, which presumably would be impossible for a mindless entity, or one that was not remotely controlled by an intelligent entity as a probe. Considering the existence of the Kordalevsky clouds, and my suggestion that they are intelligent, it makes sense that they would want to monitor what is going on here on Earth. And so what would make more sense than to have plasmoid reconnaissance? I therefore suggest that many of the balls of lightning and similar phenomena, and hence also many UFOs, are scouts and surveillance drones operated by the clouds. The sudden movements observed in so many glowing UFOs, the right-angled turns, the rapid disappearances, the vast speeds, the ability to go underwater and reemerge, and so on, all make instant sense if one assumes that they are probes from the plasma clouds. The storage capacity for information of the two clouds, which together are 9 times the size of the Earth, means that the entire history of humanity could be stored in them, as suggested earlier, and that the U.S. National Security Agency's supercomputers in Utah, which store all the telephone and internet communications on Earth, are ridiculously puny by comparison. It is impossible to resist the suspicion that the clouds know so much more about Earth events than all the security agencies in the world combined, that any attempt to equal their surveillance powers would be futile. Plasmoid reconnaissance and surveillance drones would not need to be operated by anyone, but the clouds may have created robotic physical entities to act for them. In considering ball lightning further, there are certain fundamental texts that must be consulted. There is, for example, a group of 3 interrelated books by 3 different authors who all assisted one another. 2 of them were Americans with access to extensive files of defense contractors, NASA, and the U.S. Air Force and U.S. Navy, and the 3rd was a British friend of theirs. The 3 books are The Nature of Ball Lightning by Stanley Singer, 1971. Ball Lightning and Bead Lightning, Extreme Forms of Atmospheric Electricity by James Dale Barry, 1980. Ball Lightning, An Unsolved Problem in Atmospheric Physics by Mark Stenhoff, 1999. The authors of all 3 of these books shared the same basic bibliography, which is a truly enormous one. Singer's book, which lists 594 references in many languages, was largely funded by defense sources. As he says in his preface, a major portion of the work was supported by the Office of Naval Research. It was clearly through these defense contacts that many reports, translations of foreign works, and publications that have never been made available to the public were included in the bibliographies and apparently shown to the authors for personal consultation. These include, for instance, private reports or translations on ball lightning commissioned by the private defense contractors Raytheon Corporation and Avco Corporation. The latter company, in 1960, built an experimental aircraft for the U.S. Air Force that was shaped like a flying saucer or flying disc. I have a photograph of that. As for Raytheon, everyone knows about them, by which I mean that one is continually reading and hearing that they are part of the military and security establishment. But looking through the bibliographies of these 3 books, we can see how seriously the American and Soviet governments were taking research into anything to do with plasma. Numerous researchers thought ball lightning might be harnessed for weapons, such as the directing of balls of lightning at enemy tanks and planes. So, of course, when there is any possibility of devising new and improved ways of killing people, the money always pours in to support research. A very large proportion of the research that was carried out in America and the Soviet Union on ball lightning remains secret and will probably never be released. Singer and Barry, mentioned above, collaborated on a joint paper delivered to the first international symposium on ball lightning, which was held at Waseda University, Tokyo, on the 4th to 6th of July, 1988. Singer was also an advisor to the organizing committee of the conference. The conference was attended by 54 scientists from 8 different countries under the chairmanship of Professor Yoshihiko Otsuki. The conference was held outside of government sponsorship or control. It was sponsored by a group of 19 major Japanese corporations, including Fuji, Honda, and Sony. The proceedings of the conference were published in 1988 and contain a great deal of important information. And although I have a copy myself, these proceedings are now unobtainable for sale. Anyone interested in ball lightning should try to find library copies of these important proceedings. Skimming quickly over some of the strange ball lightning phenomena that have been discussed at such length in numerous books and articles with hundreds of case reports, we find that ball lightning can enter closed rooms and buildings. It appeared frequently inside Second World War American submarines running along the floor, and it has often occurred in airborne planes. It also goes up and down chimneys, and it sometimes appears to inspect things, such as patterns on carpets. It can explode, it can be dangerous, and can even kill people on rare occasions. Usually it is harmless, but sometimes it is deadly. Another more recent book on ball lightning is Ball Lightning: Paradox of Physics by Paul Sagan, 2004. This interesting book concentrates on classifying the bizarre phenomena associated with ball lightning, which the author often calls fireballs. The author has headings such as Fireballs in Danger, Hill Air Force Base, Fireballs Defy Gravity, Line Rollers, Flyers and Bouncers, Airplane Crashes, Dazzlers and Hissers, Mechanical Damage, Electrical and Heat Damage, Electrical Effects, Trees Emit Fireballs, Atop Cooling Powers, Fireballs Eat Lightning, Colliding Fireballs, and Shrinkers and Expanders. These things are not made up. They are real phenomena. All of these bizarre events represent intrusions of plasma into our world of dense physical matter. Sagan has an important section called Do Flying Fireballs Think? This is not as fantastic as it sounds. Here's some of what he says, quote, "But fireballs possess sensory, energy, generation, navigation, and propulsion systems. Since ball lightning is buoyant, how come some fall rapidly from clouds like falling cannonballs, rebound before hitting the ground, and then float lazily against the wind or rapidly shoot back up to the clouds? How does a ball know where an aircraft is, follow it closely, and not be affected by the 500 miles per hour airflow and turbulence, and not just tumble or be swept away in the wind and turbulence? What possible detection, sensory, energy generation, navigation, and propulsion system do fireballs possess? No other natural or man-made control feedback system matches their incredible behavior. A microprocessor-based system, or fireball with sensors that can materialize and fly, then detect electromagnetic, electrostatic, metal, solid objects, chimneys from a distance, distinguish a standing person from a post, and so on, would be an amazing feat of technology. But for a supposedly hot ball of gas? It is not made of semiconductors and wires. To do these tasks of sensing, control, and navigation is not a question for technology, but a mystery of physics." That's the quote. Paul Sagan has made one major error in this passage from his book. He implies that these balls of gas are not made of semiconductors and wires. On the contrary, as we will see in Chapter 11, plasmoids can indeed have the equivalent of semiconductors within them. And as for wires, Sagan is referring to copper wires, no doubt. But much more efficient means of carrying directed current exist than wires. We have to stop thinking in terms of physically dense matter. As we will see shortly, semiconduction does not require physically dense substances like silicon and germanium microchips. And the transmission of current does not require wires of any kind. Plasma equivalents of both semiconduction and wires are fundamental to complex plasmas, especially to plasma crystals. And it appears that some fireballs, or lightning balls, are indeed complex plasmas. And as we will see later, the ones that are of that kind can be full of internal cells, semiconductor regions, and filamentary current carriers galore. We have begun building the argument to show that internal structure self-organizes and emerges from dusty complex plasmas. And some of the lightning balls are probably of that category of plasma. There are so many fantastic aspects to ball lightning, recounted at great length in the various books and hundreds of articles, that it would be pointless for me even to begin to try to summarize them all here. Ball lightning has clearly often been responsible for some UFO sightings, and that is something that requires no imagination to understand. More troubling are the connections of ball lightning with poltergeist phenomena and spontaneous combustion of human beings. There are accounts of people having been burnt alive, but their clothes left unharmed by the, quote, fire, unquote. And sometimes even their skin has been left unharmed. And as for poltergeist connections, lightning balls have been associated with strange incidents where the contents of closed rooms have been smashed as if by angry ghosts. Psychical researchers have often been called in to cases of apparently paranormal phenomena which are associated with lightning balls, just as UFO researchers have often had reports of UFOs that turned out to be ball lightning. Two other major efforts to deal with ball lightning in book form need also to be mentioned. The first is an entire volume on the subject issued by the Royal Society in London in 2002. This was edited by John Abrahamson. It formed an entire theme issue of the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society. This was a remarkable breakthrough for ball lightning research, because it showed that the highest levels of scientific establishment respectability were being accorded to the subject within the civilian context, as opposed to the secret military and security contexts. In short, ball lightning research had now come out of the closet. No longer were stuffy scientists going to say that only cranks and lunatics could discuss this subject, and treat those scientists who dared to do so as renegades. The Royal Society volume included a contribution by Stanley Singer, whose important book on the subject of 1971, supported by the U.S. Navy, I have already mentioned. At last he could come fully out of the shadows on this subject. The volume also included contributions by the Russian scientists Alexander Vladimirovich Bychkov and Vladimir Lvovich Bychkov, who have international reputations. The other publication deserving of attention is by Vladimir Pavlovich Tortugin and Alexander Vladimirovich Tortugin. Clue of Ball Lightning Puzzles. Ball lightning is light rather than matter. And that is 2015. Vladimir Tortugin is the head of the Department of Problems of Design of Information Computing Systems of High Parallelism at his institute, and Alexander Tortugin is his son. The English translations are grammatically imperfect in many places, and one must make allowance for that in reading these texts of theirs, which take the form of several booklets. In one of the booklets, they point out that there have been more than 2,000 papers and reports about ball lightning published, containing more than 200 theories of what ball lightning is. And then they say, but none of these theories seems to have gained general acceptance, because they fail to explain all observed characteristics of the phenomenon. They also mention that as little as 20 years ago, some scientists still doubted the existence of ball lightning. However, they point out that as there are now more than 10,000 recorded accounts of ball lightning, there can be no doubt that it exists. The theories of Vladimir Tortugin are very interesting and novel. He believes that ball lightning is made out of trapped light rather than plasma. However, he says, and I have slightly improved his grammar, there is usually no plasma within ball light after its generation. There is certainly no plasma after ball light penetrates through window panes, because plasma cannot penetrate through glass. Tortuguin is erroneous here, but may be forgiven for not knowing about the most recent findings, which are known only to a small number of scientists at the moment. The latest discoveries about complex plasmas are so astounding that we now know that they can indeed penetrate not only glass, but any form of solid dense matter. I wish to make the point that the Tortuguins have done a good service by discussing confined and trapped light within the context of ball lightning. As we will see later, the creation of a new kind of light and the confinement of light have now both been accomplished in the laboratory. And ironically, the most exciting part of this work has taken place recently in Russia. Though because it is known to such a small number of specialists, it is not yet known to the Tortuguins. We will see later when we come to the full explanation of complex plasmas, which is what I believe that we all are as living entities, that the instinct followed by the Tortuguins in attempting to explain ball lightning as confined light without the presence of any plasma is useful and has important and indeed essential insights to offer, because confined light is indeed part of the answers we are seeking, but within the contexts of highly complex plasmoids. Going back a bit in time, in 1943, the Mexican scientist Manuel V. Cerillo was the first person to suggest, in a report written in Spanish for the Mexican government, that ball lightning is a standing wave or soliton phenomenon. We will come to an examination of these in Chapter 11. What is important here is that lightning balls are, as I have already suggested, an example of extremely fine structures that are able to move through space and also through denser objects while keeping their shape and internal structure. In this way, one of the weird phenomena at the subatomic level described by quantum mechanics, called solitons, can also happen at the macro level in plasma. On the other hand, ball lightning sometimes seems to shatter when it strikes a surface. It can hit you with a whammy and electrocute you, or it might strike you and be harmless. The subject is still mysterious, and there is a lot to learn. One thing does seem sure, namely that plasma is involved. I have seen ball lightning only once. My wife and I were driving one night during the 1970s on the road north from Banbury in England. Olivia was at the wheel, and I was in the passenger seat, and I saw a strange light sitting in a tree about 50 feet away to the left of the road. It was an eerie, glowing sphere of mixed red, white, pink, and orange light. My estimate of the size of the sphere is that it must have been about 4 feet across. That's 1.3 meters. It did not move. It sat motionless on a tree branch. Because my wife was driving very slowly on a dark two-lane road in our old Morris Minor, remember them? I was able to observe the ball for a minute or two clearly. It seemed to consist of a luminous gas, which was effervescent and fiery. If it gave out a sound or smell, I could not have detected either because of the noise of the car engine and my distance from the ball. Ball lightning often hisses and gives off smells of sulfur or brimstone. There was no thunderstorm activity going on at the time, and it was a quiet evening. So that is the sum of my limited personal experience. My sighting was unusual in only two senses. First, that the ball was motionless, and second, that it persisted for longer than usual, as ball lightning often vanishes very rapidly. I also had the uncanny feeling that the ball was alive, which I then decided could not have been true, but nevertheless, that was the subjective impression it gave, as I had a distinct feeling of being watched by it. That is the feeling one often has when being stared at from behind and you turn around and there really is someone staring at you. And it was like the way that a barn owl, perching on a gatepost, seems to stare at you penetratingly in the flash of the headlights as you drive past it on a country road late at night. I wanted to go back and investigate, but there was nowhere to pull over. It was late, dark and cold, and so we did not bother. I have on one other occasion had the impression that I was being observed by a plasma, so I'll briefly mention the incident. During 2014 or 2015, my wife Olivia and I were asleep in a hotel room in Paris, where the usual flat-screen plasma TV set was mounted on the wall. I woke up from a deep sleep suddenly, because I felt that someone was staring at me. I opened my eyes very quickly without moving, and I could see that the TV set had somehow turned itself on and had a gray screen showing visual static with no sound at all. There was no broadcast being received, and the remote control was far from the bed, and we had never touched it during our stay. I had the subjective impression that the TV set was alarmed to see that I had observed it watching me and being on when it should not be. So it immediately turned itself off and faded to black. That is the only time that has ever happened to me. But on a few occasions, TV sets and DVD players have turned themselves on suddenly when I have been in the room, and in one case a machine spontaneously went through a sequence of three separate on switches to start working of its own accord. However, on none of those occasions did I have the creepy feeling that someone was watching me. One night, in my office, when I was working late writing something, the office printer turned itself on of its own accord and spewed out an A4 page with a photograph of my very close friend Michael Bagent, who had died not long previously. I had not touched anything but my keyboard as I worked on a document, and the printer had been turned off, remaining only on standby. In other words, the electric power was still on, but the machine was off. The photo had been stored in my computer amongst hundreds of other photos, and I had not looked at it for months. I took this as a hello from my friend Michael. When I told his wife Jane about it the next day and emailed her the photo that had self-printed, she was shaken, but very cheered up, to think that he might have sent a message letting us know he was still alive, though dead. But just so that we could not possibly misunderstand from whom the message came, there was Michael, staring up at me from the paper with that mischievous look which he often had whenever he was telling me something especially provocative or unusual. My own theory is that ball lightnings are charged plasma crystals containing a massive amount of microscopic dust particles, which become visible under certain conditions. As early as 1955, the famous Russian physicist Peter Kapitsa, that's Pyotr Leonidovich Kapitsa, suggested that ball lightning was a spherical plasma. He began his article of that year by saying, "The nature of ball lightning is not yet understood." Well, that's for sure. His main question here is, where does the energy for the ball come from? He does many calculations and makes assumptions, some of which since 1955 have become obsolete and are entirely based upon classical physics. I shall skip his discussions of energy sources, sizes, durations, wavelengths, etc., much of which I believe to be today irrelevant, and look instead at the part of his article that is still of continuing interest. Kapitsa believed that lightning balls were formed in the following manner. Quote, "Initially there exists a volume of plasma, which is small and weakly ionized. But then it resonates with and becomes excited by radiation, which causes effective absorption of radio waves. Because of this, the ionization grows, and with it also the initial volume of the sphere, which as yet has not reached a diameter d. Eventually, the resonance characteristics of the absorption process will be determined only by the geometry." End of quote. This may sound a bit confusing, but what I want to stress is his bringing in the essential matter of geometry. To my knowledge, nobody had ever done this before. He is referring to the geometry of radiation coming from a source of energy still unknown to us, as he calls it, which is outside of the volume of the lightning ball, and has created an electric field. In other words, he conceives of the electric field that supplies the energy for the lightning ball as having geometry. It is not necessary for the reader to know any more of the complicated technical details than this. Kapitsa is invoking what we can now see is a crystalline structure of an electric field. Electric fields always have structure of some kind, which can be suggested by drawings of shapes of the fields using the device known as lines of force as visual aids. But a crystalline structure is a different matter. It is a rigidly fixed pattern, which is a more ordered kind of structure, a higher level of order for a field. Such phenomena had never been imagined before. Of course, Kapitsa did not think of it like that or see that. He was, frankly, thinking of nodes, antinodes, and resonance points in the sense of their being action points or foci. He did not conceive of them as being joined in a structural entity. I look at this differently, and I see those points as vertices of a geometrical plasma crystal. But having adopted my conception of the plasma crystal, we can use Kapitsa's scheme and other similar ones as the internal structural maps of those crystals. And such resonance phenomena as Kapitsa invokes from his unknown energy source could even be formative causes of the plasma crystals. Readers may wonder about what it means to call a plasma crystal a crystal. After all, we are used to holding gems and quartz and such things in our hands, turning them around, looking at them gleam, or wearing them in rings and bracelets, etc. What possible justification can there be for calling a cloud of plasma in space or a ball of plasma crystalline? Well, it is really a scientific convention, perhaps illuminated by words on what is a crystal, from an essay by Eugene Wigner, who won the Nobel Prize for Physics in 1963. And this is a most interesting quote, which will tell you many things that you didn't know, as indeed I didn't know. X-ray studies have revealed that most of the solid bodies in our surroundings are crystalline. This does not necessarily mean that they are formed by one single crystal, although even this can be true for bodies of such enormous size as icebergs. More commonly, they are polycrystalline, like the metal parts of ordinary tools. That is, a conglomerate of microscopic crystals of various sizes. Crystalline in this connection does not mean a regularly shaped body of the kind we see in our crystallographic collections, such as museum crystal mineral specimens, but only that the grains have a regular inner structure arising from the arrangement of the atoms in surprisingly regular lattices. The crystalline and polycrystalline substances constitute by far the greater part of all solid bodies found in nature. Practically all rocks are conglomerates of crystals. Ice is crystalline, and so are all metals. The grains of sand are minute crystals, and loam also is crystalline. That means that soil, loamy soil, is crystalline. I didn't know that. Apart from the glasses and substances of organic origin like wood, there are very few non-crystalline solids. The enormous differences between the physical properties of different kinds of lattices make it evident that the forces holding the atoms or molecules together are very different. In the ionic lattices, the constituents are charged particles. The electric forces between ions are very strong. These lattices are also so constructed that the positive ions are surrounded by negative ions, the negative ions by positive ones. Since opposite charges attract each other, there are considerable forces holding these lattices together. End of quote. Wigner thus explains crystals in the wider sense to his readers. The constituents of a crystal, which for a plasma crystal means the positively and negatively charged ions and particles, form a lattice. This means that the crystal has an ordered inner structure. As we will see later, this inner structure can be very useful in the storage of memory, computation, and other faculties of intelligence. And in space, plasma clouds that are crystalline are undoubtedly polycrystalline and consist of myriads of smaller crystals. If you or I were able to stand in space next to a plasma crystal, we could only, quote, see, unquote, it if we had magic powers. Its constituent particles are far too small for the human eye to see, even with our microscopes. So there might appear to be nothing there. And such plasma crystals, especially if they are polycrystalline, can extend for gigantic distances. As Wigner pointed out, an iceberg can be a single crystal, and they can be huge. So we must never assume that a plasma crystal or a plasma polycrystalline cloud need have any size restrictions, such as a non-scientist might otherwise imagine. And frankly, there is no reason why such clouds cannot be the size of a whole galaxy. From such a perspective, our local Kordalevsky clouds are tiny and verging on being insignificant. They only seem large to us. I will add one more thought. Try and imagine the intelligence of a plasma cloud the size of a galaxy. People are always talking about intelligent life in space and wondering where they are, but they may be hiding in plain sight. Considering that our sun is made of plasma, and that stars are therefore also made of plasma, it is entirely possible that everything you can see in the night sky that is not one of our own satellites is alive and intelligent. Big red, white, yellow, and blue stars may really be the little green men. Time to rethink. In 1975, the British mathematician and scientist Harry Jones published a brilliant book about electrons. The gist of it is that free energy in the form of electrons that are bouncing around in a crystal will form complete spheres. This helped me to understand in more depth what Kapitsa said in 1955 and to develop my own ideas. When I read this, it became immediately apparent to me that if we visualize ball lightning as charged dusty plasma crystals, the fact that the surfaces of crystals containing constant energy form complete spheres when freely suspended in a medium explains the spherical shapes of lightning balls, which has been puzzling scientists forever. Convincing graphic evidence of the crystalline structure of ball lightning may be seen in an astounding photo taken in 1955 by a Swiss amateur photographer named F. Gupfert, which was published for the first time in 1965. Unfortunately, I can't show you this photograph in an audio book, but the photo shows three successive images of ball lightning flashes side by side, which, because they took place within 40 to 100 microseconds of each other, all appeared on the same photo, which had an exposure time that was longer than that. The portion reproduced here, which is reduced from 3 to 2 images because of the space of the page, shows two of them side by side. They are essentially identical, and the third was the same. What this demonstrates is that the visible electric charges were following the same complex paths repeatedly within the same crystalline structure. Otherwise, the flashes would have been random and would have varied, but they could not have replicated themselves. We need to think in terms of three dimensions when looking at this two-dimensional image, noting that some of the lines cross one another when seen on the flat, but that is an illusion because of flattening the three-dimensional image. The electricity was in fact flowing along surfaces, points, and interstices, and turning at vertices within the crystal. A clever geometer could probably even reconstruct the crystal from the path of the electric current. This kind of behavior is typical of the phenomena studied in a new discipline known as topological physics, where currents run along edges and hinges of solid geometrical forms. Plasma crystals have geometrical configurations, with surfaces, called boundaries when speaking of plasma, edges, or hinges, and vertices, or nodes. We have just seen Eugene Wigner's helpful explanation of crystals that are not the solid objects with which we are all familiar. Plasma crystals are not solid, and they are made of charged particles and ions, containing a crucial admixture of microscopic dust particles that make the crystalline structure possible. Most of them are invisible to our eyes and weigh essentially nothing. As I explained early in this book, when I stressed that the universe is made of 99.9% plasma, so that solid dense matter is very rare and atypical, so I must now stress that it follows that plasma crystals are very common, and pieces of quartz and gems are very rare. We must not take what is familiar to us in daily life as the basis for trying to understand the universe, as that gives us a wholly distorted picture of reality. Let's put it like this. No one living in the plasma universe would have any interest in our quartzes and gems made of atoms of dense solid matter. They are only important to us. We need to stop being flat earthers and get real. This means that there may be 99.9% more plasma crystals in the universe than there are dense matter crystals like quartz. So if we can get our heads around that, we can begin to see the light. We simply have to keep struggling to pull ourselves out of an Earth-centric view of things and get a plasma-centric one instead, if we want to understand the universe properly. This has all kinds of implications. Plasma crystals are capable of being fantastically complex, and complex in an ordered and dynamic way needed for intelligence. In this chapter, we have seen that ball lightning, made of plasma, has the ability to move through solid objects with its form unchanged. In this, it exhibits the same weird behavior that is observed in the quantum realm in the form of what are called solitons. We have seen that complex, dusty plasmas contain crystals that give them form, and we shall see later are crucial to understanding why plasmas may develop intelligence. In the next chapter, we will look at human experience of the intelligent behavior of plasma phenomena in ancient times, some of which seem much like experience of lightning balls. In chapters 7 to 10, we will look at the observations, research, calculations, and theories of astronomers and astrophysicists regarding plasma in space in modern times. In chapters 11 to 13, we will see how work on plasma in laboratories has confirmed and intertwined with the work of the astronomers and astrophysicists. In chapter 14, we bring all this together to summarize the arguments that complex plasma can be intelligent. We will see that intelligence of complex plasmas, such as the Kornilovsky clouds, may not be exactly like ours, and speculate that it may be more like the artificial intelligence and quantum computers now in development. Then, in the last section of the book, in the final chapters, we will look at the plasma inside our bodies and ask what the implications are. Is our own intelligence in some way dependent on this plasma?